How many books has Popper written?
Oh, that's a good question. I don't know.
No, I do have a reason.
I'm not sure actually how many altogether. I mean, he's written at least. He's written three books on the problem of demarcations, conjectures, refutations, logic of scientific discovery, and a thing called objective knowledge. Those are the three main ones. And they're all quite long. I don't know, that no account of the page. Well, it might even be interesting. No, I can't. I mean, it's about 400 pages long or something, each of them. And then there's the Poverty of Historicism, which is quite a short thing about Marx and Hegel.
I'm dreading the prospect of having to read them.
Yeah, all right. How many letters in his name? I don't know, you can count, I can't count. This has all been the Open Society at the Center. Yeah, there's two volumes of that.
Open Society?
Yeah, two volumes of that about various people, Locke and political thinkers.
We have another reference, haven't we, in the Socialist Standard, when Conrad Gournot, Professor Popper for Taft, over his interpretation of Marx last war, that kind of the last name of your three books that you mentioned.
Yeah, oh no, it's probably too technical. I talked about that, about the Poverty of Historicism, about his interpretation of Marx. I mean, I think it is a misleading interpretation, and I said why.
Yes.
And I don't know.
In your reading, did you find much of his own subjective esoteric ideas in it, or did he treat it purely objectively?
Did Popper treat Marx objectively?
Well,
I think that's interesting, actually, because I think he approaches Marx, I mean, along with astrology and Freud and a guy called Adler, which he just presupposes before he starts off, are unscientific. I think he approaches those theories in a far less sympathetic way than the way in which he approaches, for instance, Copernicus or Newton or anything in the history of physics. I think it's clear he's predisposed to believe that they're not sciences. So he's looking for reasons all the time he's reading them, why they're not. I mean, it's a very critical thing in Conjectures and Refutations called What is a Dialectic? Where he says that people who believe in the dialectic are just confusing. They're saying that there are contradictions in reality. And Popper says there can't be contradictions in reality because only components of language or components of a piece of logic can contradict one another. You can't have contradictions in the world. And he's just saying that it's a confusing idea, just a fundamental confusion. And I think, yeah, he's predisposed to believe that, to read Marx in an unsympathetic way.
Isn't it true to say that when somebody like Popper is talking about somebody being unscientific, weren't all the philosophers unscientific in the sense that various branches of their thought were not developed into what has come to be accepted as science or branches of science? Because after all, philosophy was a free-for-all, wasn't it?
Well, I mean, I did say at the beginning that the verification, well, you know, the logical positivists, right in the 1930s, and they set out to exclude from the realm of what counted as being meaningful certain branches of philosophy, and branches they called metaphysics, which included virtually the whole of 19th century philosophical thinking, or at least virtually the whole of 19th century British idealist and German idealist thought, and including Marx as well. That's one thing. They set out to exclude certain branches of philosophy from being genuine disciplines. But, I mean, I suppose you can also raise the question whether their methods themselves, the philosophical methods, conform to what they lay down as the methodology of other sciences. I mean, the question that people raise is whether the verification principle, that the meaning of a sentence is its method of verification, is itself verifiable. I mean, can you verify the principle that the meaning of a sentence is its method of verification? And I mean, some people say no, you can't. I mean, how do you How do you subject something as abstract as the meaning of a sentence to empirical verification? So, I mean, it looks as though it might be self-refuting, because you can't subject the thing itself to the same kinds of standards as it lays down for the whole of the sciences. But, I mean, that raises the question, the whole question that this thing is directed towards, what is it to be scientific anyway, and whether that's a useful or a meaningful question.
One's a language philosophy, the other's a philosophy about all sorts of things.
What, science?
The verification of whether what you are using the language for is, you can verify it, other than the language. Isn't that a problem of language philosophy? Whilst the philosophies of the ancient Greeks and so on are something quite different.
You mean it's that there's a different, I mean, this is getting into another area, really, whether there's a different approach to philosophy, which is a philosophy of language, and that's it is a 20th century development, and that's different from theories of metaphysics and theories of knowledge and so on, which is what people were putting forward in 17th, 18th century. But I mean, I don't know, that seems to be another question.
Copper wire and that type of scientific experiment that we put in the laboratory. And I think you're just referring to pre-death metaphysics. Right? But when Mark was talking, he was talking about history. This is a fact. I mean, sequence in time. And although it is singular and you can't go back, at least his criteria were based on changes of the social relationship of people to the world and the material world, and the relationships of people to each other at various stages in these changeovers. So I should say that by looking at it is very viable at the instances that he's talking about. In other words, he's not just talking about history as an abstract, he's talking about history as people lived it. And this is a fact. You can't put it in a laboratory, true, and repeat each individual esoteric thought and idea that happened to individuals in it. But you can take a general change at a particular length of time, and this is verifiable. And I should say that this is a scientific method.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose it depends what you take. I mean, if you take a basic principle of materialism, say, or of historical materialism, say that, I mean, this is obviously going further back than stating the materialist conception of history, but just something like people need to satisfy their basic needs before they can do anything else, and you say that's a basic materialist theory in contrast with, say, an idealist theory. I mean, it's arguable that that's, I think it's arguable that that's more verifiable than something like the being of my me, is it one with the eternal no, or God is omniscient and omnipotent and so on.
Yes,
I'm just agreeing with you that, it's arguable that that is more likely to be verifiable than something metaphysical, something clearly metaphysical.
Isn't this much hypocrisy? It's the love Marx. Marx didn't say, look at history, without forming his theory first, he didn't say look at history, and then, laws of induction, by repeated observations of what he saw in history books, and then form his theory out of that. What did Marx look at history? He was already looking for those kind of things in history, So he wanted to just confirm what he was self-confirming things.
I think that's kind of what he's, one of his criticisms. Well, I mean, I'm not sure, but it's certainly like that. But also that it's such a very, and I'm sure, perhaps a lot of historians would agree that it's such a very general theory, insofar as it tries to cover the whole of history, that it's very difficult to know what could count as a confirmation of it.
Philosophy is divided up by lots of people, including also, divided into idealistic and materialist philosophy. Idealistic philosophy, apparently, is based upon metaphysics. Now, What would you, in your view, be the determining factors which would divide a metaphysician or an idealistic philosopher from a materialist one?
Well, I mean, I think it actually is a different question. What divides metaphysics from science? From the question, what distinguishes idealism from materialism? And I think that this is a very complex question. I mean, there's a whole range of people who call themselves idealists who really believe that the starting point of any investigation in the theory of knowledge is the mind and what the mind receives from something which is outside the mind. So the starting point is the mind and not, if you like, the world or matter. And you build up a picture of the world from something which is internal to the mind on a sort of crude caricature of an idealist position. And then the question whether that kind of epistemological view, that view about theory of knowledge, is correct as against the materialist views. And I don't think it's a question that we can really answer just now, whether it's really related to the other question.
Mind without taking into consideration the factors that give rise to it. I mean, mind is something, not something that is abstract. Mind only comes into the earth when you've got thinking animals. And it presupposes a materialist background. So if the starting point is to have a concept of mind, then speculate as to what stimuli or impressions the mind has, you're surely starting off from an idealistic basis, aren't you?
Well, I mean, I don't know why we ought to get into this really. It's very abstract.
Why not?
Did you investigate the 19th century definition of science?
You mean a lot of 19th century positivist definition, or... That's an interesting question, yeah, because...
We've got scientific socialism, which is a term which English used. If you identify scientific socialism, some people do, with Marxism, then perhaps we should have really found out what Engels meant by science.
Mm.
If he was right in his definition of calling it scientific socialism. Mm.
Well, I mean, yeah.
From the question of the discussion.
Also, yeah. In fact, looking at Marx's writings, and certainly Marx thought that he was being scientific, didn't he, for example?
Yes.
But actually, in his economic writings, he thought that Capital was a work of science.
Mm.
Certainly Marx saw his work as being scientific. Would you not like to comment then on the kind of Marx's and Engels' views of science?
Yeah, well, I mean,
he wrote letters where he said, such and such is beneath the contempt of a man of science.
Mm. Well, I mean, and then the whole load of... I think, actually, the views of some of the people who were writing in the 19th century, and people who were called, two kinds of positivists, the logical positivists, the ones I talked about, but also the 19th century positivists who influenced, I mean, people like Kant and Mill and Buckle writing about history, and other people as well. I mean, they're, in a way, their theories were very similar, at least as far as their presuppositions and the tradition that one can say that they're part of. They were very similar to the people I've talked about, the 30s Vienna positivists. I mean, Mill believed in the inductive method. And I'm sure that all of that Engels, I mean, at least according to a whole lot of people who write about Engels, and perhaps rather than Engels himself, I'm sure that Engels was influenced by the 19th century positivists, at least as far as his view about science and what it is to be scientific was concerned. I mean, he thought it to be very important that the laws of society, the laws governing the movements of laws governing change in society, were also laws governing change in nature, and so to that extent, he believed in the unity of science, along with the positivists, that the methodology of the social or the historical sciences was mappable onto the methodology of the natural sciences.
Of course, the problem isn't what they believe in science. I mean, all of them take the same attitude, observation, accumulation of data.
That's right.
Analysis,
all the
verification. And it's on the last three where they differ. In other words, and this is where the subjective elements come in.
Yeah, well, they all accept Popper, and Popper thinks he's different. They all do. He thinks he's really criticising the whole of the tradition in philosophy of science up until 1936 when he produced his first book. I mean, he thinks he's provided a solution to the central problem of the whole of scientific methodology, which is the problem of induction. And how do you get from observation of particular cases, which is all you can observe, to a scientific law or a generalisation? You can't. No amount of positive instances of. If you just take these crude cases, you want to prove that gold, all gold, is a let's say it's a yellow metal. How do you prove that? Any number of cases you present, it's always possible there may be a case of a piece of gold that's not a yellow metal. So any number of cases you happen to have produced don't provide you with conclusive evidence in favour of a generalisation. And that's a presupposition, really, of 18th century positivist science. I mean, it wasn't called positivist, empiricist science.
Who have power within the system, and this has happened all the way through. And our problem isn't the reality of the scientific method that we've used, but the people's attitude, knowledge, and mainly, and their dynamic attachment to a system that's actually against their interest. I mean, this is our basic philosophy, isn't it? I mean, the capitalists themselves. They believe in the materialist conceptionistic. I mean, they're operating it all the time, aren't they?
Do they?
They bring in all kinds of ideologies to hide it, but nobody can't operate without outside.
I wouldn't have thought they believed that. I mean, one very important thing. I wouldn't have thought they believed that capitalism was merely one historical phase in the evolution of things. I'd thought they believed that it's.
I mean, people of power. Who had a certain relationship to the means of production and a different social relationship to other people who had the means of production. I'm not just talking about it happening in a particular capitalism ran through history and marked it. I mean, and the problem is the ideas that people have about it. I mean, it's not the actual scientific thing itself, and our problem is to get rid of this ideological, ideal dynamic attachment that people have to the power system.
Mm. Yes, well, I would like to thank Alison for this talk. There are people, and unfortunately, in my view, far too many in the party who think and who say quite openly that all this is a bloody lot of nonsense, a stupid waste of time. You should be out somewhere doing something, and if you do this, you're only, the usual phrases, you're discussing like the monks how many can dance on the pint of the needle and so on. To me, the tragedy of this is that so many members of the party are completely oblivious to the fact that there's a mountain of literature being written to try and refute and confuse and abuse Marxism and Marx's writings, to which we have very little to say. I mean, unfortunately, there are a number of sectarians in the party who think that the way to deal with all this is to ignore it, be an ostrich and it will go away, and you keep repeating the Declaration of Principles. Now, the fact is that many, many people, of course, are involved in all these writings. I can cite you a very good I took the science course of the Open University. Well, obviously, in the first lesson that they give you, they try to tell you what science is, so you'll know what you're taking on. And unfortunately, I didn't bring it, but I'll bring it next Tuesday. They gave five definitions of what science is. So you can take your pick. One was, it was a very obvious one, which most people think, the work of scientists. A bloke in a white coat with a bald head holding up a tube, a test tube, or delivering a baby. Another one, of course, is scientific research, what's called extending the frontiers of knowledge. Another one is the theories, whether you formulate theories. I just can't remember the other, but there are five that they put forward, all of which could work. I mean, you could say, yeah, right, that's science. But in our case, I'm sorry, I've got a disagreement with you, darling. I don't share the view that we should ditch the word science. I don't share the view that it's obsolete or out of date. And I do think, in spite of Popper, and who's the other one, Mises, and a whole host of them, I've got a list of them like that. In these courses, one good thing these courses do, the reason I ask, you don't have to read all the books.
Oh,
it's a prison sentence. They give you extracts. They give you the guts of it. The guts of Popper's contentions on it. The thing is, having read all this, I still come back to what our old friend here said and somebody else at the back. It's the question between metaphysics and fact. It's the question of what's called a priori. Whether you assume that God exists and go on from there, or whether you say nothing exists and examine facts. Darwin said, I started with no preconceived idea, I just collected facts. And when you collect facts to a certain extent, the accumulation of facts itself, if I can be Hegelian for a moment, the quantity turns into quality, and the facts presume some hypothesis. Which then, and incidentally, whatever Popper or anybody else, the fact is that the entire methodology of science is verification. Must be. I mean, when rather, and the whole work of science, nobody does anything on his own, not even Marx or Darwin. When Rutherford split the atom, several hours as soon as they knew the method, they did it as well. And when a scientist thinks he's on something new, he has got a breakthrough, he publishes it. And it goes out to the world. And the world, the scientific world, controls it. They mount similar experiments. And whatever Popper may say, this is what works. We had the caloric theory and the phlogiston. You know the phlogiston? Priestley didn't know that he'd found oxygen. He thought there was some invisible stuff.
Phlogisticated air.
So I would say that, in my view, I think we're on fairly safe ground in the party in saying that we still hold Engels' view that what is utopian, all the writings were fanciful. Fourier and people like that, they didn't take the facts, they said what they would like. But the Marxian way was to actually examine facts first and conclude from facts. I'll go back to all these books, and some of them that you mentioned, and check them all out again. But up until the moment, I don't regard Popper's books as a serious refutation of the party case.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting that you should say, I mean, given that you're so familiar with what goes on in sciences, it's interesting that you should say that. I mean, given what people talk about as the kind of developments in quantum physics, I mean, where it's not clear what the facts are, and that's the big problem for theorists, for Heisenberg and so on. I mean, whether there are such things as subatomic particles that possess both momentum, or that you can't, there's things that are such that you can't measure their position and their velocity simultaneously, and whether it makes sense to say that it's a fact that there is
a subatomic particle.
Yeah, I mean, and also, you, so many. But I mean, and so many cases of things like, you know, so a potter making pots. It's surely a fact that the potter's making pots, but you wouldn't say that's scientific. I mean, hundreds of cases you could produce like that where what you're talking about is factual, but that doesn't make it scientific. And it's a big question. Is someone who proposes a flat Earth theory proposing something that's scientific? Is Aristotelian physics, which they Aristotelians would have argued is a factual discipline, is that scientific? Is Ptolemaic astronomy, which... that people then, at that time, would have regarded as factual.
It was
factual.
For its time.
Mm. But then... Yeah, I mean, absolutely, you can't... Yeah.
I don't accept that.
Yeah, no, you can't. I mean, you can't accept that, as far as Marxism is concerned.
He may have had Aristotelian physics had certain restrictions and limitations, in much the same way as any ideas have got limitations in relation to what is to come. But as far as I'm concerned, Aristotle was wrong. Well, it was wrong then, and it's wrong now. I mean, the fact is that Democritus, in contrast, was right. He lived about 400 BC, and Aristotle around about the same time. One was right, in my view, and the other was wrong.
But how can you show that, Harry? I mean, how can you show that?
Verification again. Verification. By other people who call themselves scientists, such as Copernicus and Galileo and other people, in relation to Aristotelian physics. The fact that the universe expanded under that under those ideas, and the Earth wasn't the centre of the universe, and the Earth went down the sun, and all these facts which weren't accepted by Aristotle, not in that way anyway. And Democritus, who along with other Greek philosophers, whose names I can't
remember. Heraclitus.
Yes, that's right.
Epicurus. Where are we?
They put forward the atomic theory of the construction of the universe, and in general, they were not pretty primitive, right? Because other things have occurred, and it's become a question of empiricism now, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, the atom was shown to be in existence and to be physically constructing the known universe. I'm not going to go into a long discussion about whether black holes exist or antimatter and all the rest of it. At least the best part of the universe can be shown to be atomic in structure. The atomic bomb has been discovered, and you've got atomic
drops
and all the rest of it. I mean, you see, I would say that in the case of certain people in history, have come to conclusions which have added to the knowledge of mankind in a positive way, which is more scientific than perhaps to be correct. Put it that way. I mean, you see, I think this is a hackneyed proposition, I know, but I think it's a true one. Marx gave to political economy what Darwin gave to the theory of evolution and biology, and that is something which can't be separated from those disciplines. I mean, it's nonsense to talk about mathematics without taking into consideration Leibniz, Schopenhauer, and Einstein, as it is nonsense to start talking about the theory of evolution without taking into consideration what Darwin and Wallace said about it. And they have said things which are still right now. They've said some things which have been proved to be incorrect, but the main contention can be shown to be correct. Now, I would say that Marx's contention in relation to the historical development, historical materialism, and to his analysis of capitalist society is a correct analysis. And consequently, it was true when he made it, and in my view, will always be true, even although capitalism goes out of existence. And looking back, if it becomes an abstraction, then it's still correct.
Well, I listened to what Harry Young said, and I have to say I disagree with you, darling. I guess
none of that.
Not here, not today.
Because when you say that the sort of scientific approach is just collecting facts, I would say that the scientific approach is not that. That the scientific approach is the selection of facts, and it's the decision to omit certain things from your selection of facts, which makes it scientific. In other words, if you're looking at, say, the reasons why there was a revolution in Russia in 1917, you try to collect historical facts. And there are facts which exist which you will never know about. And there are facts which you will know about which will not become historical facts, because for the sake of, because the facts you're selecting are only answers to the question you pose in the first place. Why was there a Russian Revolution? Which, as soon as you ask the question, presupposes that you're going to call it a Russian Revolution and that you see it as being a revolution, which is something which, a question which really you can't verify until you've actually determined what caused it, and then you will discover whether it was a revolution or not. So, in other words, all of these things are simply a case of selecting questions and then selecting facts in order to substantiate the answer, and then perhaps deciding that the question wasn't worth asking in the first place, or that the question was worth asking and that you've got a useful answer. But in order to do that, you have to then have a whole framework. And before you start making the framework and asking the questions and getting the answers and substantiating and throwing aside and doing all of the other things, the question ought to be asked, which I don't think has been asked here today, why do you do it at all? And here, I think, is where Marx did have a scientific answer. I think the reason you do it is because it's the collection of historical data is predictive. I don't know if you said that, but I think that's what's scientific about history. That's what I've thought. That the reason that Marx started out, not from history to a theory of the present, but I think from the present to a theory of history. In other words, he started with the terms of the class struggle and created an historical theory based upon the class struggle. Not because that was the only historical theory, which is where Popper is wrong, but because that is a particular historical theory suiting a class society. And incidentally, I would therefore say that in a socialist society, you would have a different theory of history. In a socialist society where you are not then working on the basis of property divisions and class divisions, you may well then develop a theory of history which is, for instance, purely culturally based, not looking at class divisions, but looking, say, at cultural links of one kind or another right the way through the whole of property society and pre-property society, which would be a different thing. But for the sake of Marx's science, he in fact developed a political theory based upon the interest of the working class, which isn't therefore objective, but is, I would say, scientific, because it's predictive. So in other words, the party would take the view that, as I understand it, that crisis is always followed by a period of economic expansion in capitalism. That is not based upon anything except for a scientific prediction, which doesn't therefore mean that it's an objective prediction, as I understand it. It doesn't mean that it's something completely removed from the class interest of the working class. Nor is it something which is a purely arbitrary prediction, that is to say, which isn't based upon a selection of facts about the past. But it's a scientific prediction just because it has the quality of being predictive. And then if you ask, how can you tell, how can you verify any prediction, I would say you can verify each prediction in different ways. In other words, you can verify the prediction that one race is not superior to another, and therefore the use of immigration controls or extermination of races will not solve economic and political and social problems on biological criteria. And then you can argue that a slump is always followed by a period of expansion on social and economic criteria. And you can take each of these and you can verify them each within different disciplines. But they're all scientific on the basis that, as I understand it, they're predictive. And I think if you actually start out by asking why do people study history at all, it's just the same as
Socialist Party, National Front, is that the definition?
It's just the same as asking people who've lived in through a previous generation what it was like. That's, I think, why people study history, because people have an urge and a need to know what happened in the past. But they don't just want to know what happened in the past as a kind of isolated series of arbitrary facts, but they select the questions that they ask and they put them in some order in accordance with their own needs. And that, seems to me, is using history as prediction, and that is what makes it scientific. And that's why I would say that from the point of view of the working class, the materialist conception of history is scientific, because it actually has predictive value for the working class. Without the materialist conception of history, the idea of socialism would be far less coherently explained for the working class. And that's why the materialist conception of history is scientific, because of that predictive value. But I would agree with you, and I think that you were talking about prediction as well, when you said that people can use science in order to change the predictions that they have, like the one you gave about the stock exchange or whatever it was. And that actually came true. If you looked after the election on May the 5th, shares rose on the stock exchange because the capitalist class believed their own propaganda about the Tory government. They didn't believe it for very long. They believed it for about half a day and then went down to the prices that they had been before. And it's the same. Wars have taken place, battles and policies by governments have taken place because people have believed their own predictions. So that might then be an extra qualification that whether something is scientific and therefore, according to what I understand by scientific, predictive, isn't the only important thing, but the important thing is, which class is science? Is it? Is it the science of the working class? Because if so, that is predictive for the working class, and an altogether different scientific approach by another class would be predictive and of value just for that class. And I could think of things, for instance, from the point of view of the capitalist class, where it could scientifically try to discover what happened in history, as was said, that some members of the capitalist class have sort of adopted the materialist conception of history and try to use it for their own theories of history and their own predictions, which would be a completely valueless for the working class, which seems to throw into question Harry Young's old idea about science being classless. Because I would say that if you're going to take history as being a predictive science, then it's a predictive science for the working class. And if you go to a member of the working class whose only interest in having any kind of history, any study of history, is to bring about social change, to bring about socialism, then you could say that that is a socialist theory of history. But if you were to go to a member of the capitalist class and say socialism is inevitable or socialism is probable given these circumstances, then that's something which, in fact, wouldn't be history in the interest of that class, which leads me to believe that the prediction which is involved in science isn't something which is classless, but it's something which is entirely based upon class interests.
Mm. Oh, you might not, can I say something?